Well, alrighty, gang. Welcome back to the Gutowski Files, starring our very own Stephen Gutowski, is the founder and editor at large. I like that. That's going to be your title now. Over at thereload.com. That's thereload.com. He is the head honcho over there. Do me a favor. Go over to The Reload when you get a moment and check out getting a membership. He relies on your membership dues to fund his important work. Stephen, how are you, sir?
I'm good. Again, I think editor at large, usually that means in the industry, like, you don't work there full time, but
listen, it sounds cool. Don't come at me with all your facts and proper nomenclature.
Large editor, maybe.
You're a lot less large than you were a year ago. That's good.
Yeah.
More hair.
Yeah. The hair is definitely larger.
I think our viewers and listeners need to know that every week before we start, Stephen mocks my lack of hair and his beautiful, gorgeous, luscious, curly locks, and he makes me feel bad about myself.
That is not at all true.
Every week.
Bald is beautiful. The bald with a beard look on a man, like man of our age, that's a solid look. Look at basically every action star out there.
It's true. Jason Statham, Bruce Willis. There was an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm where Larry David is talking to a police officer who shaved his head, and he's like, "I'm bald just like you." And Larry David's like, "No. That's a look you're cultivating. I have to do this. I have no choice. That's how I feel. This is
bald privilege. What is it? Cultural appropriation.
Yeah.
Of bald
so,
people.
Yeah, this happened in 2006. I woke up and went, yeah, no, let's go. Just rang, off it went. So, all right. This is worse than sports talk. Hair, no one wants to hear hair talk.
Hair talk. This is a stylist's podcast now.
If you want to hear a hair talk podcast with Steve and Mike, let us know and we'll consider doing that as a sidekick. So this week, we wanted to first talk about who you just had on the Reload podcast. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, we had this one's been pretty controversial, pretty heated debate, as you might imagine from the topic here. But we had Matt LaRosa. Matt, I always get everyone's name wrong.
Sorry, Matt.
Matt LaRosa, who is a gun rights lawyer in Florida. I'm pretty sure I still pronounced it wrong. He runs a channel called FUDBusters on YouTube, but he's a prominent gun rights lawyer and activist. And he was the one who wrote for us. We talked about this topic a little while back on our show here, but there was a federal judge who ruled that nonviolent illegal immigrants are protected by the Second Amendment under the Bruin standard, the history and tradition standard set by the Supreme Court in Bruin. So he argued that was the correct reading. And so we had him on the podcast to do a little bit of a deeper dive into that issue. Cause it's obviously one, especially on the right where, you know, you tend to have a lot of the political coalition of the right has gun rights in it, but also border security and is general opposition to illegal immigration or people who've overstayed visas or crossed the border illegally, you know, what have you. And so this is an issue where you see those two things kind of colliding. And so there's a lot of heated opinions on it. And I figured it would be good to have Matt on and give him a chance to fully flesh out his arguments. And I think it was a good episode. You know, it's on YouTube and it's on anywhere you get podcasts as well.
Very good. And if someone does join The Reload as a member, there's a possibility they could be on the show themselves, right? Without having to die, like you have to do to be on my show.
Absolutely. The standards are lower to be on The Reload's podcast as a member. You know, it's anyone who wants can do a member segment with me. It's one of the better segments. We get to talk to our community, the people who are funding the work that we do at The Reload, and get some insight into it. There's a lot of different people from different backgrounds and different interests. And it's always fun to do those interviews as well. And then we had one about a week or two ago. So check that out too. Check out you also of course get the podcast a day early, the interview podcast. There's that advantage as well.
Very good. So go check it out. TheReload.com. So this week we are discussing, an analysis piece over at The Reload by Jake Fogelman, who I still want to have him on the show one of these days. So make a note of that.
Yeah. You do that.
Analysis piece titled ATF report suggests licensed gun dealers are not fueling black market sales. Now to a lot of us, this is not a huge revelation. Anyone with an FFL that wants to keep their FFL is going to stay as far away from doing any shady stuff or allowing, you know, known straw purchasers to buy guns at their shop or at their business or whatever. But apparently this might be news to the ATF. So you can tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, so this was a report that the ATF put out on Thursday last week where they looked at, this is the National Firearms Commerce and Trafficking Assessment. This is volume 3 of this particular report. You know, lots of government bureaucracy naming in here.
So like a spellbinding read, yeah.
Yeah. This was the first comprehensive analysis of their tracing program, you know, where the ATF, when they recover a gun at a crime scene, they try to trace it back to its original origin and figure out how it got from, you know, the last person who legally bought it to the crime, right? That's the basic concept of the tracing program. So this looked at, this is the first report on that since 2000, where they're looking at criminal trafficking of guns. And they looked at over 9,700 firearm trafficking investigations between 2017 and 2021. And they found that 1.6% of those cases involved an FFL, somebody with a federal license to sell firearms. And that account that works out to about 136 incidents. And that was obviously a very small percentage of the overall number of trafficked firearms. The vast majority of them came from straw purchases and unlicensed private sales. In all likelihood, an unlicensed private sale where the person understands that who they're selling to is not legally allowed to have the gun.
Right.
That's not in this report, but that's a common, yeah, commonly what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, do we know, generally speaking, of the ones that were found to have involved an FFL, was it that the FFLs were in on it necessarily, or was the FFL the last stop that gun had before it went to the hands of a known criminal? Or can you kind of expound on that a little bit?
Yeah, this was essentially situations where they determined that the licensed dealer was in on the trafficking, that they knew that was the purpose of these sales. And so, you know, these are corrupt FFLs is what the ATF calls them in this report. So these are people who are, at least according to the ATF, are aware. I'm sure there's, you know, I'm sure there's disputes over this in court over some of these cases, and the criminal likely resulted in criminal charges. But according to the ATF, these would be people who were FFLs who were aware. Obviously, all gun sales at some point originate with an FFL, with a federal firearms licensee, because new gun sales have to go through them. But of course, the time to crime, this from a different report, but the ATF's time to crime, they put out a report every year on that. And that is usually around a decade. I think it's been a little bit sooner, more recently, but still around like eight years. So 8 to 10 years is usually how long it takes for a gun to go from first sale to being recovered in a crime. And so FFLs might have sold a gun to somebody 10 years ago, and then that gun changed hands a couple times before it makes its way to the person who commits a crime with it. And I think that's a fairly common path for crime guns. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say the vast, vast majority of firearms that I recovered or that was involved with an investigation that were recovered. And this is investigating cartel members on both sides of the border. It includes transnational gang members. And then it includes just prohibited possessors who happen to fall under our authority, the agency that I worked for in one way or another. I don't remember ever in 25 years, I don't remember ever seizing a gun that ended up being just bought by that person, that prohibited possessor, from an FFL, never once. And, right. You know, I didn't do a ton of gun cases, but I did enough of them where the idea being, look, we have a bad guy. Maybe he's been deported previously as a felon. So he was here legally, had a green card. He committed a serious felony, serious enough that they removed his immigration status and sent him or her back to wherever they're from. They come back. They are by definition doubly a prohibited possessor. They're a previous deport, right? And they have a felony history. And so that person's looking at a lot of time, 72 months or more for felon in possession or prohibited possessor, you know, possession of a firearm. And those guns were invariably First of all, most of them were crap. The ones that were not crap were stolen probably pretty recently from someone from a private party. Word to the wise, very, very frequently out of a vehicle, out of a center console or a glove box or a trunk or right. a little crappy trunk safe or whatever.
And stolen guns show up in this report as well as a common driver.
I would say at least half of the guns that we seized were stolen, serial numbers obliterated, the whole nine yards. And I got to be honest, doing the ATF trace on that stuff, which is sort of standard procedure, you know, in a felon in possession or a prohibited possessor case, never really understood. I don't know what value we got out of knowing where the gun had been previously, but that was always something we had to do.
Yeah, that's something I've always questioned as well, is how valuable these traces are, because of what you just described there is most crime guns are old and they've changed hands quite a lot and likely more than a couple times after the last sale that went through a licensed dealer where there was a background check performed and there'd be a paper record that the ATF can look at. Obviously, I'm sure there are cases where traces make a difference. But I would imagine it's not most of them.
Yeah. And I've never had one come back where it linked. We had all sorts of databases we use and I can't talk about them, but a lot of them talk to each other. The databases do, especially post 9/11, so that hopefully we don't miss anything. And I don't recall ever seeing one where it was linked in with like a bum FFL or somebody that was knowingly, you know, selling to straw purchasers. But I do know agents in my old agency and other agencies that worked a lot of border cases where they were, you know, just crates of ARs going south and they were going to the cartel every single time, or just crates and crates of 223 or, you know, 9mm or whatever that were being bought by straw purchasers. But almost every time those FFLs did know, there's no way they didn't at least suspect something was fishy and didn't bother telling anybody. So it is a thing. It does need to happen, but wasn't terribly practical for any of the cases that I ever worked anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, one of the interesting things about this report is that number, the 1.6% being traced to corrupt FFLs, is actually down significantly from the last time they did this report, where it was actually closer to 9%. So the industry has actually gotten better at, we have fewer of these corrupt FFLs now than we did back in 2000, I guess, is sort of the conclusion you can draw from that, which is interesting, especially given the political situation at the moment with President Biden and the ATF, because one of the significant things he has done since he took office is to institute a zero tolerance policy for ATF inspections of FFLs. And that has led to a significant increase in the number of FFLs being pulled, number of people having their licenses pulled by the ATF over things that, where there wasn't, you know, it didn't necessarily result in someone obtaining a gun illegally or a very serious violation, but, you know, other paperwork violations or failing to do a background check. A lot of them actually when we look through this, and this doesn't cover all of them, so there certainly were FFLs who got their license revoked because they knowingly did something illegal.
Sure.
But a number of the ones I looked at involved an FFL accepting a out-of-state concealed carry permit as a valid replacement for a NICS check, because a lot of states allow you to accept concealed carry permits in lieu of doing the next check, the National Criminal Background Checks system check. But you can't accept out of state ones. And apparently there are at least a few of the FFLs that had their licenses revoked. It's still not a huge number of overall, but, you know, you're going from a handful of FFLs revoked each year to like 100+ being revoked now per year. And so, a number of them have to do with this misunderstanding about accepting concealed carry licenses, which didn't, a lot of these cases, then it didn't lead to anyone who's prohibited actually getting a gun, but, because it's, the ATF now deems that a serious violation that's revocation worthy, you're seeing a lot more of it. But yeah, you know, so this report kind of undermines that whole effort by the administration, because it shows that it's really not licensed dealers who are driving the crime gun scene in the United States. The black market for guns is not coming from licensed dealers selling out into criminal gangs on purpose, right? This is not what this report is finding.
Yeah, and that was my next two questions, probably my last two questions. One is, and you may not know, and maybe we can get a commenter either here or with the reload to answer this question, but can an FFL, whether it's a storefront or someone doing it out of their garage or whatever, can an FFL just deny a sale without giving cause? So, for example, if he just gets a bad feeling about somebody's like, this guy looks shady or whatever, does he have to give a reason? Is he or she in risk of losing their FFL if they do that more than once? And the other question is, or I guess observation, I would hope that the ATF, first of all, I hate zero tolerance policies. They're almost never a good idea. But I would hope that an agent doing an inspection or an auditor, whatever you call them, at an FFL would take into account mens rea. Is there any actual intent to do anything wrong when someone, so if I go to your, you know, Mike goes to Stevens gun store in Northern Virginia and I have an Arizona CCW, and a Virginia CCW is sufficient to bypass a NICS check in Virginia, are you knowingly doing anything wrong by accepting my out of state one? And couldn't this have been a bulletin they put out? And I bet you they didn't, ahead of time, to all the FFL saying, hey, just so you know, you cannot, you may not take an out of state CCW or CFL or whatever it is as sufficient to not do a NICS check at your place. I wonder aloud if they did that and why that isn't being considered before they revoke somebody's license. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, for one, is my understanding as a reporter, not as a lawyer, to be clear, is sure. That you can deny sales if you're an FFL and you just have like a bad feeling about the way somebody's acting when they come to buy a gun from you, even if they pass the background check or what have you. You okay. can, I believe you're allowed to just deny the sale on your own personal concerns. Now, I assume you might get into some trouble if the reasons you're denying someone a sale are discriminatory in some way.
Right. Sure.
If you violate some other kind of equal protection law by denying sales, then you might run into trouble on that front. But, you know, as far as I understand, you can deny sales if you're, regardless of what the background check says. And then, you know, as far as the second question goes, you know, when I was reading through, and these revocation reports are public. If you're a Reload member and you read this piece, we have links to some of them, and we have a link to the database of them as well, so you can go through and read them yourself and get an idea of like how the ATF agents are, you know, these IOIs, the inspectors, are conducting these revocation processes, conducting this process, and what they're using as justification. The ones that I read, is often, even if the FFL said there was an honest mistake on their part, that wasn't, you know, essentially a good enough reason. There is like a knowing aspect, like, but what the ATF considers to be, you know, somebody doing something knowingly can also involve like there's instructions written somewhere that they could read, or should read, but didn't, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily that the person was intending to break a rule or what have you, but if the rule is laid out, I guess, in a way that the ATF considers to be plain enough, you can still have your license revoked over running afoul of it, even if it's not a repeated problem. That's kind of one of the big things that the Biden administration has changed. Like, you don't get more than, you don't get a second chance with some of these things. It's mainly surrounding whether or not you perform a background check. To be fair to the Biden administration, I mean, that might be something that people should read these for themselves and decide what they think is too strict on this front and what they think is not strict enough. Most of the ones I read involved somebody not performing a background check on during a sale. And it was usually because they thought they didn't have to because the person had a concealed carry license, but it was an out-of-state concealed carry license, right, which doesn't apply. And that can be fairly, that's a fairly technical thing, right? Although obviously you can argue an NFL ought to know that, right? That's their responsibility to understand it, but
it's literally their business. Yeah, I get that. But
yeah, I mean, but it's sort of up to, this is not how the ATF used to do things. So it is a change, and whether people think that change is appropriate or not is up to them, especially in light of this particular report, which shows that, you know, FFLs are not driving black market gun supply at this point. So
I would not deign to ascribe any motive to the Biden administration as it relates to firearms. All right, folks, that is our time for this week. Stephen, as always, sir, I appreciate you coming on. Folks, if you've made it this far, leave us a review. If you can spell Gutowski, I'll send you a lollipop in the mail. Not really, I won't do that. But if you can spell Gutowski, leave us a review yourself, so we know you made it to the end of this particular episode. And go over to the Reload and give them a look. Please consider getting a membership. As I said at the start, Steam relies on your membership dues to fund his important work, and nobody else is going to do it. So just like the NRA is the big dog, you know, in gun rights, we need to preserve it. We need to fix it and get it healthy again. We need to make sure you support things like active self-protection, like the Reload, so we continue to do the work that we're doing that I don't see anyone else getting to. So again, appreciate you listening. Steven, as always, sir, you have the last word.
Absolutely.